When can martial law be declared, and when can you be picked up, detained, tried by a military commission? Today on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis, the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy, acting again as host. I'm also the Executive Director of Camp American. And today I have kind of a special guest. I've been coveting your prayers for Barry Sheets, and he's on the other end of the line. We're doing this by the miracle of Skype. He's still feeling a little under the weather, so we still covet your prayers on that. But Barry, you sound a lot better than you did earlier this week.
Well, you know, Chuck, thank you for having me back. I appreciate it. I am feeling a little bit better than I did earlier in the week, but this has been an ongoing thing for about 3 weeks now. You know, I feel sorry for anybody else who's got this because it's something that it's just nagging enough to be distracting and tiring and you just can't get rid of it, but it's not big enough that you feel like you have to go and seek medical attention for it. It's one of those type of illnesses. So I've covered it, everybody's prayers. Thank you. I think it's helped make it not be any worse than it is. But, you know, like I said, I think I've got a few critters swimming around there. Maybe I need to go and just round them up and detain them without purposes of trial or any kind of law of habeas corpus.
That's right. You need to declare martial law on your sinus infection. Luckily, there's no House of Representatives or Senate to deal with that. Unlike our own government here, and that's something that I've talked to you about and that we've been talking about here on the show for the last few days, we've been talking about the National Defense Authorization Act, which we originally brought to you as a warning against S-1867. We will now kind of expand on what we talked about yesterday, and that was an extremely important case, Ex parte Milligan. Ex parte is important because it pre-invalidates the National Defense Authorization Act. And by that I mean sections of the NDAA that allowed the arrest, detention, and military trial of American citizens even when the justice system is intact and operating. That is the declaration and practice of martial law by the president or the whoever sits in the executive branch. The Supreme Court has actually already ruled in Ex parte Milligan that that just can't be. So bear with us as I read from a book called The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution. This is a book, by the way, that I believe is available in our bookstore, and you can find that by just clicking on bookstore, and you can buy a copy of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution. This is from The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, and it's written by Kevin R. Gutzman, who is a PhD and a Juris Doctor, an associate professor of American history at Western Connecticut State University. He has a master's of public affairs from the University of Texas. And he has co-written a couple books with one of my favorite authors, who is Dr. Thomas Woods. I don't necessarily always agree with Gutzman, but I always find his stuff very well researched and always very well written and very informative. Here's something on Ex parte Milligan that sort of pre-negates those tenets of the National Defense Authorization Act. And he says, quote, "In Ex parte Milligan, the Supreme Court greatly restricted the ability of the executive branch to enforce its will in wartime. In other words, we're in a war on terror, so supposedly we're in wartime." Gutzman continues to write, "Lambden P. Milligan had been charged with conspiring to seize federal munitions and to free Confederate prisoners. Justice David Davis for the unanimous court, remember, we talked about this yesterday, it was a 9-0 decision. Good luck getting a 9-0 decision these days, right, Barry?"
That's correct.
Yeah, we don't get those very often.
No.
"Justice Davis said that the Constitution was not suspended in wartime, but applied equally in time of war and peace. Thus, trials before military commissions such as Milligan had received in Indiana, well behind Union lines, well away from the war zone, fell afoul of the Constitution's requirement that suspects be indicted before trial and that they be tried publicly before juries so long as civilian courts were functioning." One of the things we talked about yesterday, the reason that the federal government handled it this way rather than indicting and attempting to try Milligan and his cohorts for treason, the reason they weren't indicted and charged with treason was because it automatically implied that there was a foreign power involved.
Exactly.
In other words, it wouldn't have been an admission that the South had truly seceded and was, that's right, from the Union and was actually a separate country. Since they were unwilling to admit that, what they instead did was proclaim a rebellion and an insurrection and claim that these guys were insurrectionists and wanted to try them by military court as revolutionaries, essentially, insurgents, if you will. And there is a difference between rebellion and insurgency. You can be a rebel and not necessarily be an insurgent, but you can't be an insurgent and not be a rebel. It's very difficult to explain, and perhaps we'll call up Webster's 1828 before too long. and look up those definitions for you. But what they were trying to do was protect the idea that the South had not really seceded, even though we were at war with them, and that these men were in support of them. Therefore, they couldn't really be tried for treason without admitting that the South was out of the Union. I think you can see that where one of the major problems with that argument lies. What it would require was that martial law be declared and the military act as a police force. Well, that's not allowed according to the Posse Comitatus Act, which was actually a direct result of things that went on during the Civil War.
Now, for our listeners, you may have gone over this already in a previous program. I know we went over it a couple of weeks ago. But just a quick refresher on what the Posse Comitatus Act.
Okay, the Posse Comitatus Act was an act that was enacted after the close of Reconstruction. And what it does is it forbids the military to be used within the borders of the United States as a police force. What was going on in the South essentially was that the United States military was being used as an occupation force and a local police force. Essentially, it was under martial law, under military rule. Whenever some general or a colonel would take a whim and didn't like something that someone had done, they would simply issue an order that they be arrested and bring them in and try them under military law. That is not permitted under the Posse Comitatus Act. So what the National Defense Authorization Act actually does is twofold. And what's interesting, we talked about this, Barry, earlier. President Obama actually objected to that portion of the bill. In his signing statement, what the portion that he objected to was the use of the military as a police force. He did not object to his ability to declare martial law and to detain indefinitely United States citizens, although what he said was, I have the power to do it, but I'm not going to.
Which is small comfort, to be quite honest about it.
Right.
But Chuck, you know, you and I both know full well that the comments that he made in those signing statements were all couched very carefully, so to give him wiggle room. In other words, I'm going to tell you how much I think this is distasteful while I'm signing it into law. We've heard that before. We had another president who looked at something and said, this is blatantly unconstitutional and the courts will declare it such, signed it into law, and then got a little shock when the U.S. Supreme Court said, nope, it's constitutional. That was the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform, and the president was George W. Bush.
Yes, and that's right.
So,
he was using the same tactic. He was using these signing statements. The signing statements to say, I don't like this law, and I'm not going to, Obama has taken it a step further and said, I'm not going to enforce parts of it.
Right. But you know, honestly, Chuck, when you get to looking at that, he could say he's not going to enforce it, but to martial law being declared, what other choice does he have? You know, this will be, say, I have no other choice. I must turn the military against U.S. citizens.
Well, I think actually what he thinks he can do is federalize local police forces.
We've seen that tried before during Hurricane Katrina.
Yes, and I think that was the warm-up for federalizing police forces. It didn't work out there, but believe me, one of the reasons they do dry runs like that is to find out where the problems were and figure out ways so that next time it happens, they can solve them.
They can get on top of it, that's right.
I think one of the first things they're going to do, and one of the problems they had with Katrina, was they didn't disarm the local population quick enough. They made an attempt at it. Civilians actually found themselves holding people that were there to help them. They weren't there to help them at all. They were there to exercise power. And they found these federal agents found themselves being held at gunpoint. I know of a specific case where FEMA jumped on a box truck and said, we're confiscating your truck for the delivery of food and other goods. And three people that were in the truck pulled pistols and said, oh, no, you're not.
Think again, my friend. Think again.
What's important about this ex parte Milligan case is some of the things that pop up in it. What goes on in this is that they make direct reference to the Bill of Rights in here.
Yes.
So that's the reason why the Bill of Rights was so important and why James Madison was wrong in originally opposing the Bill of Rights, because it wrote it out and put it into law, and it put it into the highest law of the land, the United States Constitution. Basically, you've got sections of this thing that are just stunning to read. Neither the president nor Congress nor the judiciary can disturb any one of the safeguards of civil liberty incorporated into the Constitution except so far as the right is given to suspend in certain cases the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus. That was at what ex parte Milligan was all about. He had been sentenced to death by this military tribunal, which had no authority to sentence him to death. And President Johnson, by the time this came around, Lincoln had been assassinated, and President Johnson basically affirmed their convictions, but commuted their sentences to life. Well, Milligan, who was a sick man, basically said, no, thank you. We're going to go to the Supreme Court on an error of writ. That's a legal maneuver anytime a court has either not been allowed to look at something or has issued what the petitioner believes is a writ in error. And that's why the Supreme Court heard this case. And an ex parte case, as we explained yesterday, is a case where only one of the parties is present. And that party was Milligan, because he was suing the entire federal government, essentially.
Indeed.
So a citizen not connected with the military service and a resident in a state where the courts are open and in the proper exercise of their their jurisdiction cannot, even when the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus is suspended, be tried, convicted, or sentenced otherwise than by the ordinary courts of law. Right there is the wedge that you use to pry apart the National Defense Authorization Act. The Supreme Court has already ruled on this, that what the NDAA allows is not constitutional.
Well, but Chuck, we're also assuming that you're going to have someone who's going to want to file a suit and attorneys who are going to be willing to go against what's considered standing precedent to file this. The question is, how are the courts going to look at it? Yes, ex parte Milligan is setting out there, but we have an act now that was basically on its face unconstitutional, which honestly, so was McCain-Feingold when it came around. And the funny thing, NDAA and its horrible provisions were authored by the same man who authored the Campaign Finance Reform Act, and that was John McCain.
Isn't that interesting?
Of course, he had help from Carl Levin with this one. But the point is that everybody assumed the courts would just say, well, yeah, based on our previous case law, that's unconstitutional. But yet the courts decided precedent didn't matter at that point with McCain-Feingold, and they upheld it. Now, subsequently, other challenges were brought that were more specific on point, and parts of it were taken apart by the courts, but not initially.
It's falling piecemeal rather than ex parte Milligan, which basically crashed down on the heads of the federal government in one fell swoop, which is what should have happened in McCain-Feingold.
Well, it should have. And so we have to be careful because, number one, it's going to take someone. And again, if you take a look at NDAA, usually the courts look for standing, for somebody bringing a lawsuit. In other words, a party that's going to be injured or has been injured by the enforcement of the act that's in question. My fear is, concern, maybe not fear, my concern is that in order for there to be a plaintiff against NDAA, especially these provisions, it's going to have to be someone who's been pulled from their bed at night, detained without access to counsel, who can be detained indefinitely in undisclosed locations, but still be an American citizen. Question is, how are they going to bring the suit?
And that's the bottom line, because what the NDAA allows is people to be United States citizens to be hauled off to places like Guantanamo Bay and restricted from access to their attorneys and having all communications with attorneys monitored, even have the basic amenities of privacy for their defense. And in fact, again, these people can be tried by a military tribunal wherein a civilian lawyer may not have any real, it could be a kangaroo court. You've raised an excellent point that I tried to make yesterday and I hope to make today, and that is the Supreme Court in 2012 is a very different body than it was in 1866 when ex parte Milligan was ruled on.
This is very much the case. I don't think we have a similar structure of the jury. As a matter of fact, if you look, our Chief Justice and at least two of the other justices who have been appointed in the last 6 years all have gotten their seats by swearing a fidelity to precedent, to stare decisis. Let's see how well that holds up. Because obviously, the guiding case law in this is ex parte Milligan. It's just a question of whether Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito and maybe some of the Obama appointees who stood in front of that same Senate and Senator John McCain and said they'd uphold the precedents of the court. Now is an incredible opportunity for that. And the point is, it can't come too soon because NDAA, regardless of how you feel about our defense forces, ladies and gentlemen, regardless of how you feel about supporting our military, under the guise and under the cover of a patriotic feel of supporting American troops, we now have put American citizens' very safety at risk from those same forces.
Well, Barry, unfortunately, we are out of time. Maybe we should consider that part of this discussion, moving it on till tomorrow.
Okay, sounds good. Hopefully my voice will sound a little bit better.
Hopefully. And brother, we're praying for you to recover quickly. Folks, we invite you to tune in tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.